Okay, welcome back to the Investigative Journal on this October 9th, 2014 day on our calendar. And I'm your host, Greg Anthony, and you're listening to FirstAmendmentRadio.com. I'm here every Friday, 6 p.m. to 7 p.m., that's Pacific time. Now, today I wanted to continue on that road of showing you the irregularities in the Tony Lamo trial and the legal documents that are supporting that. And I've got my hands on them, and I went over that on our Monday show. I began that, and you can go back to my Monday show to get the beginning of that argument that I'm making, that he didn't receive a fair trial. His attorney representation at the outset was deplorable. And many of the witnesses were not called. But before I do that, and I'm going to get to that right away today, I'd like to mention that the reason I believe he's being framed, as well as Tupper Saucy and others that I've mentioned, is because of his outspokenness against the Vatican, the Jesuit order, and showing their complicity with nefarious affairs, both spiritually and secularly in our country. And I might add that the Jesuits have been very successful in carrying out the purposes of the papacy's Congress of Vienna, Verona, Chieri. Look at those. You can Google that and find that very easily. The Jesuits, I believe, with the aid of the CFR, control the highest echelons in the political, judicial, banking, business, media, and religious arenas in the United States. And I think throughout the years I've tried to cover each one of those points. And there's so much more to do. However, with the low budget, I think we've enlightened more people about what's really going on than big news media has, and even these big internet stations that have a lot of money coming in from God knows where, to show you this point and why it is really, first of all, a violation of our Constitution, which in my estimation was written up as merely a document, a propaganda document that we use to tell the world and tell our citizens that we are the freest country in the world, but behind the scenes, it's completely opposite. Now, when America, when these people that Alamo and others have been talking about for, like Tony, for 40 years, when the Vatican failed to get America into the League of Nations after World War I, they created the CFR, which began immediately to use our schools, colleges, and media to condition Americans to accept the Jesuits and their underlings and their workers and our government, their second attempt to create a world government after they orchestrated World War II. And America was so conditioned by then that they accepted the United Nations and joined it. Now, if you want to go back to some of my old shows and others who have talked about really what is behind the United Nations and the reason it is there, go back to many of my shows back in, I think, 2009, 2010. The Jesuits are extremely dangerous to this American Republic and always have been. Now, remember, Kennedy, although some people will find some faults about him, of course, you're going to not everybody's going to, and I'm not saying that all the things he was doing I would agree with either, but he rejected their plans and really did fight their agenda. And for this disobedience, actually being a Catholic himself, he paid for it with his life. But since then, we have many, many pawns in the Jesuit scheme, and I'll give a few names. Richard Nixon, Adlai Stevenson, Hubert Humphrey, George McGovern, Eisenhower, and current members of the Council on Foreign Relations. I think Alan Greenspan was still there, Newt Gingrich, Richard Gebhardt, George Herbert Walker Bush, George Walker Bush, Cheney, Colin Powell, I'm going back, Sandra Day O'Connor, and all the other new guys that are joining this club are all in bed with the organization that I'm mentioning. Now, major corporations that are under their control, we know that. The Bank of America, we got Ford Motor Company, Boeing, Pepsi, Heinz, Lockheed Martin, Time Warner, and Chevron. In the media, NBC, CBS, New York Times, Washington Post, Newsweek, and Time. And in the alternative media, we have the American Free Press, we have Genesis Communication Network, Republic Broadcasting Network, all in bed with the Jesuits, I believe. Now, you can do your research on it. If you find contrary opinions, if you find things, let me know. I think the internet is more dangerous than actually the news, the mainstream media, because they purport to give you the truth. They do give you a lot of things, but they then take a little sidetrack and lead you down a path, so you never get it all. And that, you know, a little bit of truth is, I think, is worse than getting a bunch of lies, because, you know, if you're smart, you can figure those out. It's harder to figure out a lot of truth and then a little bit of misdirection. That becomes more dangerous. And don't kid yourself. When this internet was started, they knew it was going to. I mean, most people get their news from it, right? Today, for example, in the morning, I was walking through town, and a lady was trying to get into this little grocery store to buy a newspaper. And, you know, she was an elderly lady, and it was not open. And she said, "Where can I find a newspaper? You know, an actual newspaper with newsprint." And I said, "Well, you got to go around the corner. There's one over there," and blah blah blah. And I said, in passing, I said, "You're one of the last few people that still read one, don't you?" And she kind of laughed, and she said, "Yeah, it's an old habit." And the point I'm trying to make is that the internet has taken over. And don't you believe that these people would know that, and then they would try to dilute, to poison people who actually want to get to the bottom of things in a truthful manner? Oh, of course. So I just wanted to mention that. And for that, I believe that Tony is paying the price of 175 years on charges that are quite flimsy, if I may add. And you'd have to, we'll go over those in shows to come. And I've gone over them in the past. But remember this, yesterday on my show, I gave you a good analogy of where Tony Alamo sits and where a lot of priests in the Catholic Church who have been nabbed red-handed with dastardly crimes against children, they're not put in jail. Many of them are sent to this kind of retreat run by the Vatican and the Catholic Church, with some secular help. And it's a place where they put them. They get colored TV. I mean, they live pretty, it's like a retreat area where they're supposedly getting rehabilitated. So that's how they handle a lot of these people. And when you talk against them and you're basically opposed to them, they frame you and then throw you in jail for 175 years and make it look like, you know, Tony's the bad guy, to put it into a, you know, an everyday man's vernacular. But anyway, let's look at some more irregularities in this case, and I'm going through some of the legal documents, like I said. And regarding Tony's recent appeal to get a new trial, which was crafted by another in a long line of attorneys, apparently now those who are behind Tony and representing him are happy or content with the attorney they have now. And the legal document is a long one. It's about, 50, 60, 70 pages. And I'm going through it because it's important to understand how this legal machine works and how it can screw over a lot of people. But there's an affidavit that's attached to this document, which lays evidence to what I said in the original show I did Monday on this legal document, which outlined the first attorney who took this case collected $350,000 and then promised to do a good job but went on vacation, was never available, and finally dropped out, and so on and so forth, and basically did nothing. So an affidavit came across my desk. And I've got the document in front of me, which was given to the court in 2012 to show that Tony didn't get a fair trial. Many of the witnesses that were to be called on his behalf were never even contacted by the defense. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. I mean, you'd at least contact them to find out what they say and make a decision whether you think they'd be a good witness or not. Wouldn't you think so? They never even were contacted, and this is verified. And the document states that people that were working to help these attorneys from the Alamo Ministry had communications with attorneys in advance of his July 2009 trial in his case that I'm referencing. As Tony was detained pre-trial, these people participated on his behalf in assisting people from his ministry with the investigation conducted by his defense by providing the names and contact information for witnesses who had useful testimony at trial. Now, this would be important, wouldn't it, to rebut what I considered to be the flimsy charges against him in a violation of the Mann Act? And so this was provided to defense investigator David McConaghill with a list of witnesses in March of and April of 2009. Sufficient time to at least contact them. Their contact information was given. And people, the list included Terry White, Nina Romero, Mary Ann Barnett, Tom Barnett, Brian Broderick, Deborah Andrasek, all this is public record, Vicki Larson, Tamala Reed, Dennis Hagen, Angela Andrasek, Sally DeMolin, David Sheff, Mary Jane Sheff, Rebecca Coonan, Rose Pacheco, Peter Pacheco, Mark Coonan, Myra Coonan, Brendan Broderick, Shirley Gibson, John Pugh, John Peeler, and Don Sweet. None of these witnesses, folks, in what I just read, were called at Tony's criminal trial. And from speaking with these individuals, members of the Alamo Ministry who were trying to help Tony, who was in jail, and others close to these people, that not many, most of them, were not even contacted. Including John Peeler, the guy who was the FBI informant. Okay? Now, I'm not sure if he was contacted, Peeler, or not, but he didn't appear. Now, there are a number of names here. Most of the names I mentioned were not even contacted. And that, to me, is ridiculous. There's also affidavits indicating that David and Mary Sheff were never contacted by defense investigators in preparation for his criminal trial. This is consistent, you know, with the knowledge that they had that many of these people were basically forgotten about, right? And that to me is just incredible. Just incredible. And so let me continue on this. So can you imagine what kind of trial this would be? I mean, he had only a 10-day trial, and maybe because they didn't bring anybody. I wonder what his defense, we'll see in the documents, what it was really like. It seems pretty shabby to me. Now, one person from the Alamo Ministry met with McConaghill before trial regarding this testimony, but however, many people from the Alamo Ministry are going to help will never met with defense attorneys to review potential testimony. And the meeting with McConaghill was brief. He took some notes and did very little to prepare me when this one person took the witness stand on his behalf. Now, the failure of this preparation to me is prejudicial to Alamo's case, isn't it? And that's stated in the documents. Had attorneys prepared witnesses, even interviewed them, they could have testified in greater detail about the alleged victims, their interest in making the trips in question, which is the key to this, intent in the Mann Act, cross state lines with a minor to have sex is a crime, but they were going to show, and all these witnesses were going to show, that there was never any intent for sex, and that the ministry took many trips in buses, in cars, to their different locations across state lines. And they were going. This could tell more about the purposes, the interest in seeing new, exciting places and being close to where things were happening in the church. unprepared by the defense counsel and ask ambiguous questions to at least one witness who came on his behalf, there was a focus only on Tony's purposes of travel, which was not the issue before the jury's consideration. The issue is, what was the purpose, you know, not only of Tony, what was the purpose of the travel? What was the purpose? Why did these supposed four or five girls, who I might add it were sent to a place that they were, boy, you know, coerced. They were interrogated. They were coached on what to say, and I went over that on how, and we'll go over that in other when we get into the specifics in the his motion that's before the court right now. It's been there for almost 2 years. Judges are busy, aren't they? Or they can just maybe put cases aside they don't want to deal with. So we have this document stating all these witnesses never appeared. Now, we also have a document from... let me go back to... there's one document I have here that's written out, and I've got to. I'm gonna decipher that in another show because I can't quite read what was being stated. So I'm gonna go over the. And this was sent to the court as one person who should have been on the case, should have been a defense witness testifying regarding some of the travel and the reasons behind this travel, and nothing really happened. But was not given a chance to testify, and that we'll go over that because this is a long a document. Now, what I do want to go over is an affidavit sent to the court by John Peeler. Now, he has I've mentioned him many, many times on this show, and John Peeler is a. Let me see, 6 minutes here, so I will go over that in a minute. But anyway, John Peeler is an undercover FBI agent. Who came on my show many times and told me that the government had asked for his services to bring this ministry down, and he had tons of information about how the government was setting him up and framing him, which the jury never heard. And the judge, because of Peeler not being called, was never asked to rule on whether this was very convenient, isn't it? If the defense doesn't call him, the judge doesn't have to rule that his testimony is either irrelevant or relevant, which, you know, on appeal would be a huge issue. And I don't see how any court could get around the fact that this is not relevant information. So if you're in cahoots with a defense attorney who doesn't call somebody, that makes it harder on appeal to get this case overturned, doesn't it? So a lot of things can, you know, it's a little club. Listen, I have a law degree, and I'm not saying there aren't good attorneys out there who would say that. I mean, I'd never say that. There are some people out there that are respectable, people who uphold, you know, what justice should be. But there's a lot of corruption, and there's a lot of finagling between defense attorneys and prosecutors, and it's a little club, so to speak, for these people. And, sometimes things go on that you wouldn't believe that you... So what I'm getting at is the reason that Peeler wasn't called, that's a strange... All I'm going to say is it's very strange. And here's what Peeler said, because he gave an affidavit to the court, which means that if it's false, he can be jailed for perjury, right? I, John Peeler, is a resident of Arkansas. I've been for years. Prior to Tony Alamo's trial in July of 2009, I was contacted by Mr. Alamo's attorneys regarding information I had. So they contacted him, right, concerning Mr. Alamo and the circumstances surrounding an investigation that led to his arrest and prosecution. Okay? During my conversation with Mr. Alamo's counsel, I expressed my willingness to testify in Mr. Alamo's trial as a subpoenaed hostile witness. I stayed in contact with several members of the Alamo Foundation, including member Don Sweet, during the time period leading up to Mr. Alamo's trial. According to members of the Alamo Foundation, Mr. Alamo's counsel informed me on several different occasions that they plan to have a subpoena issued for my testimony. The Alamo Foundation members called me several times prior to trial to ask if I had received a subpoena yet. I never did. I was never contacted by Mr. Alamo's counsel again to discuss my potential testimony, and I was never asked to testify at trial. Now, what happened between that time? They said they were going to testify. The defense counsel says he's going to testify, and then he didn't. Was there a conversation with the prosecutor? Now, this testimony could have, you know, maybe led to Tony's acquittal. When you hear what Peeler had to say. Now, at trial, I would have testified to the following matters, and these are general things. I was a former violent crimes task force operative, informant, and employee assigned to undercover operations for different governmental agencies. I was sworn in the Honorable George Howard Jr., the United States District Court for the District of Arkansas in 98. Present at my swearing-in were FBI agents Glenn Jordan, Bill Buford, and Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, BATF. Now, let's stop right here, because I've listened to his testimony regarding what he was asked to do by the government, which would show categorically that they were trying to frame this man for years. Now, if there was a question, now, if the defense doesn't call him, my question is why? And if their answer is, well, we can't prove he was an actual employee of the FBI or an undercover informant, well, then here's the deal. First of all, you'd have to understand that if you understand the CIA and the FBI, they can wipe people off the books at will if they want to. And you know what I mean by that. He never worked here. No, we don't have any records of that. One little push of the computer button and they're gone. Now, the point is, with these names, Glenn Jordan and Bill Buford, they could also testify. Bring them up on the stand. And then do some digging. And do some digging. And find out. Maybe some other people will come out of the woodwork to prove that this man actually is telling the truth. But it wasn't done. To me, miscarriage of justice. A defense attorney who's either in bed with the prosecution or is just there to collect the money and get the hell out as quick as he can. And it's just amazing to me. And we're going to continue. I just want to make sure I don't go overboard here. And I got about a minute and a half. Always checking the watch. So we were going to get back with his testimony in a minute. And I've got with Peeler's, what he's saying in his affidavit, which to me shows. But we're talking now, the man's already spent how many years in jail? This is 2009. And it's already 2014. This appeal and all this stuff's been on the judge's desk for 2 years. To me, you know, is there anybody out there that knows of the Innocence Project? I hear about all these, I see these TV shows that are getting people out of jail that don't belong there. Is there anybody that could maybe lend assistance to this man that, and when I say that, I say that in sincerity, let's get to the bottom of this. Because if these people can do this to him, they can do it to anybody. They can do it to you if you decide to express your First Amendment rights. And show, you know, I mean, the information that is out there showing what I am telling you on the show and others who have looked at this to be at least on the table of discussion is amazing. And it isn't. And when you do this, you're considered to be a crazy person, or you're considered to be, oh my goodness, you're violating the sanctity of the Catholic Church. Well, hogwash. There's no sanctity there. They have been stealing and corrupting people for years, and I mean, the evidence is right out there for you. And we continue to overlook it. Now, John is in a basement mixing up the medicine. I'm on the pavement thinking about the government. A man in a trench coat, patch, I've laid off. Says he got a bad cough, wants to get it paid off.
hear it first on FirstAmendmentRadio.com and FirstAmendmentRadio.net.
I know you all want answers, and believe me, so do I, and I'll do my best to get them.
Have you seen the Left Behind movies? Have you read the Left Behind fictional book series? Not everyone believes Left Behind is true prophecy. Some may even regard as conspiratorial the mainstream re-release of the Left Behind movie with actor Nicolas Cage portraying the main character as an attempt to further reinforce in the minds of all this perception of false prophecy in order to condition the masses for the play about to begin. Because they see the world stage shaping to fulfill what they have been led to believe is sound biblical interpretation, a left behind rapture scenario, this false view of prophecy is reinforced in the mind, not only of its adherents, but also includes those who have been merely exposed to the specific media. Is it possible that false prophecy can be fulfilled? The rapture theories have always been in dispute. Pre-trib, mid-trib, and post-trib disputes have risen up in exclusively evangelical circles of recent history, so that when true believers don't suddenly disappear, this element will easily go by the wayside when all see a new Jewish temple begin to be built. Will this be part of the great delusion that will come upon the whole earth? It seems that this great prophetic delusion has already overcome practically the entire American evangelical and Christian world. Get the book, The Rapture Will Be Canceled. To learn more, visit crosstheborder.org. That's C-R-O-S-S, crosstheborder.org.
Since the beginning of time, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it, it has been traded, it has been borrowed, it has been purchased, it has been stolen, there's a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty, to ourselves and to our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188 or visit discountgoldandsilvertrading.net. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, right here on FirstAmendmentRadio.com at 4 p.m. Eastern or 1 p.m. Pacific Time. Visit discountgoldandsilvertrading.net or call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, 1-800-375-4188.
Okay, we're back for the second half hour of the Investigative Journal, and let's get right back to John Peeler's affidavit sent to the court showing that he should have testified in the Alamo case. Now, in the first half hour, I mentioned that he was an undercover agent hired by the FBI to find out, and investigating Alamo since 1998, that he was also assigned to plant evidence that he was to bring this man down, to frame him, so to speak, and he testified to that on my show. And I showed that his original defense attorney had contacted him and said he would appear and testify on Tony's behalf, which I believe could have led to an acquittal with this damaging testimony. And then all of a sudden he was never called, and I questioned what happened between that time. What happened between the time that he was told that he was going to testify and then he never did the time of trial? Was there something going on between the prosecutor and the defense attorney? Interesting. But he never did testify. And here's what he said in his affidavit. He presented evidence of people that swore him in to this organization, to the FBI. He had evidence and names of people that gave him his orders. And then he said, for several years, I investigated Tony Alamo starting in 1998, and I was assigned to infiltrate. Not to honestly go there and say, you know, to infiltrate the church and its business operations with the goal of finding some kind of criminal evidence against Alamo. Now, he spoke with numerous people in his church. He also spoke with Alamo on several occasions. And after several years of investigating him, now remember this, after several years of investigating him, he found no evidence of criminal activity or a criminal organization in either his personal life or his business operations. Despite the lack of evidence that I presented the Violent Crime Task Force, they continued to pressure and push me to find something they could use against him. So, basically, they're trying to frame him, right? Various situations were set up in an effort to catch Mr. Alamo engaging in criminal activity. However, none were successful. Mr. Alamo would take no drugs, money, or weapons. So, basically, this guy is infiltrating, trying to get him to do something wrong, and he didn't. We wanted nothing to do with anything. He wanted nothing to do with anything illegal. When I relayed this information to Violent Crimes Task Force, BTF agents Glenn Jordan, Bill Buford, and FBI agent Kenneth Petros, they became extremely upset. They were intent on prosecuting Mr. Alamo, and when I could not report back to them with any evidence of criminal activity, they wanted me to fabricate evidence. I refused and subsequently left the Violent Crime Task Force. Since then, my son, John Christopher Peeler, have been subjected to repeated threats and harassments from the Violent Crimes Task Force, the Little Rock Police, and other governmental agencies. So that's what he said on me. That's what he said to the court. And this was in November of 2012. Nothing since then has been done. The judge is sitting on it. As of today, there's nothing done. And Peeler had been on my show many times after this, even after, well, when Tony was still free, went on my show, Peeler apologized to him for what he did. And basically, after Tony was put in jail, Peeler came on my show a couple times and talked about these irregularities and goes into depth on what they wanted him to do, and it showed that he was asked to really frame Alamo. Now, if this could be proven, I doubt that these charges would have stuck. But, for some reason, they weren't, and Mr. Peeler never got to the court. Now, he's given an affidavit. I mean, he's subjecting himself to perjury and jail time, if this is not true. He's given names. I mean, that's enough for the investigators to really get into this. But do they really want to investigate this, is my question. It appears to me that they don't. And, you know, there's a lot of different other... there's an affidavit from Deborah Andrasek. And I can get into that as well. And she testifies to some interesting things that would have helped Tony basically show that these charges were not true. And basically, this goes on for the affidavits here. And I'm going to get into a lot of these in another show because there's about 90 pages of different people who have provided affidavits of reasons why they should have been called to testify to discredit or show that the charges against him have been trumped up. And there were four or five complainants and defendants people who, girls who had come forward with this evidence in violation of the Mann Act. And I do not have time to go over these. We got Nina Romero, we got Deborah Andrasek. All these are affidavits filed on behalf of Tony who would show that he, that basically these charges were trumped up and they were not allowed to, they were not even called to testify. And I mean, the evidence goes on and on and on, and it's sitting on a judge's desk for 2 years. Now tell me there isn't something going on here that we should need to know. Now, and for another show, I've got so much information. I mean, I've got the affidavits of all these women and men who testified that never got a chance to do that in court. And I will get to those on another show, of course. And it's important that we get into this stuff. What I did want to mention, I want to go back to some things here. That when you talk about the goal, see, the whole thing here is that when we're getting into the, you know, I want to stop here on the legalities. And my next show, I want to go back to his motion to quash this trial and to basically appeal his conviction and get it overturned. I want to get into each count against him by the four or five complainants. And I think you'll find that quite interesting. But I'll do that at another time. It's going to take about a couple hours to go through that. But I think it's important. Because in this case, like I told you, there's a lot of things going on here. There's his criminal trial, which we're going over piece by piece here. Then there's the custody cases of all the children that they basically the state rounded up and took from their parents, which is a way of dismantling this ministry. And I have a lot on the custody cases that is, shows that the government lied, shows that something was going on. And now how many Catholic kids ever get taken out of their schools? Ask yourself that question. How many kids? They're still going. I mean, you can get 100 different rape charges and that in a Catholic school, and that school is open the next day for business. And they say, it's one bad seed, don't worry, the kids are safe. Well, I swear to God, you know, I went to a Catholic high school and grade school, nothing ever happened to me. But, you know what, looking at all the information now, I would not send my child to a Catholic school. Not at all. And they would be safer somewhere else. But the state here rounded up these kids. They did a SWAT team raid on this ministry. They contacted 150 media outlets to convict this man, even end this ministry as a cult, even before there was any kind of trial. And when you're looking at this trial, my goodness, I mean, it is so obvious that something is going on here that we need to get to the bottom of. And nobody's going to do it. I mean, where's the Innocence Project here? Are they really... You know, are they given only certain cases they're told to go after? Look, there is so much protection for the people that are behind all of this stuff. Why do you think they didn't call Peeler to the stand? Just use your head. This would have opened up so much a can of worms. Jobs could have, you know, and do these investigators really want to go after the FBI? You know, they could become a target, too. They know that. That's what's happened here. And when the people that I'm talking about are protected by our laws, and then they can selectively prosecute and shut up, silence anybody who's going to put a roadblock into their plans, we don't have a constitution. We don't have a free system. We have a fascist system. And this case shows it. So stay tuned to some of my other cases. My other shows regarding this trial and other things. But I want to spend the last 12 minutes talking about religious terrorism in America. And I'm going to refer, every now and then I go back to a book that's, you know, for people who don't read in this country anymore, it's only 140 pages. It's worth reading. It's by Bill Hughes, The Secret Terrorists. He wrote this book. Oh, God, I can't remember when. 2002. And he passes out. He was a minister that passed these out free all over the place. So I want to just refer to him because this is the reason. When I talk about all... Oh, and don't forget we got a civil case to go over where they're collecting one judgment against the Alamo Ministry. It was $532 million, the largest in Arkansas history. And there's a whole huge story there that we have to go over. And don't forget Tupper Saucy in this. I wanted to mention that people say, well, why don't you write a book about both these guys? And I said, no, people won't, you know, too many bad, you know, people don't read books anymore. They do, but, I mean, I want to do a theater play about it because I think people would like to see it in front of their eyes. And maybe that'll cause people to think, even after we're gone from this planet over the years. And that has to be crafted very very wisely, and I'm trying to do my best job on that as I speak. But I want these stories to resonate and be in a medium that isn't as easily to, you know, they could take the book and just get rid of it with one button on the computer, couldn't they? Now, according to Bill Hughes, and we got all those particulars in this case, but we got the overview of why did they come down on him? Why did they hire Peeler to bring this guy down? And why did they, you know, because of his views towards the Jesuits and the Vatican? And the question that Bill Hughes asked then: Where is the Jesuit agenda for America and the world heading right now? And for over 200 years, the goal has been to complete destruction of the U.S. Constitution while using it as a ploy, I might add, to create this fiction of freedom. This would mean the utter demise and annihilation of precious freedoms guaranteed by that document. But what good is a document if it's not put into practice? I ask that question. We have this right of free speech, free press, freedom of religion, and paper, or the right to worship God according to the dictates of one's own conscience, the right to bear arms, the right to a fair trial, and the right to personal privacy would all be eliminated. And we're seeing in the case of Tony Lamo, many of these things already have been eliminated. God according to the dictates of one's own conscience, the right to bear arms, like I said, the right to a fair trial, the right to personal privacy, are gone. For the past several years, we have seen this war on the Constitution even get bigger and bigger and bigger, says Bill Hughes, and freedom taking place in earnest. People basically realize, you know, there's so much. I mean, unless you're one of these people that just want to live in ignorance and bliss, ignorance and blindness, and you don't want to know any of these things because, you know, I'll just think I'm free. And if I don't say anything and don't do anything wrong, then nothing will happen. But by doing that, you're locked in. You might as well be in prison yourself. It's not the purpose of waking up in the morning, is it? Now, in the religious arena, says Bill Hughes, the goal, let's look at the religious arena here, of the Jesuits, is to wipe out any trace of Protestantism, and I'm going to add criticism of the Vatican and their deception and their infiltration and their deceit. That's the problem here. I don't care if they practice Catholicism. You know, they can worship Mary as till hell freezes over, as far as I'm concerned. But when they start taking away the rights of others to practice their religion and to say the truth about certain things, then we got a problem. Now, they want to wipe out any trace of this and restore one worldwide domination by the Pope. And that we see through their 200 concordats, which is a legal agreements with civil and governments around the world, which give them special privileges. Next, Hughes wants to determine if the Jesuits will be successful in these purposes. Now, that's the question everybody asks. You know, when I started doing this, they would all, you know, people... I had calling. I don't take callers for a while, probably for the next 3 or 4 months. And the reason I don't is because I never get anything done. And not to say that you can email me, I can get you. But when I used to do this, people would be thinking about what they were going to say, and they wouldn't listen. And not to say that I have all the answers, but I'm not giving you my theory. I'm listening to others and then bringing it to you. So I have to do the listening. Then I can do a half hour, an hour of talking. So I listen a lot more than I talk. But when I did call-in shows, people, I mean, the questions they would was, what can we do about it? Where are we going? And I'm look, they're always into the future. Into the, and I'm going, what, do I have a crystal ball? I don't know. There's things that can happen. But anyway, this question always came up, so let's deal with it right here from Bill Hughes' point of view. The only, he says, next we will determine if this plot will work. And he says, the only reliable source you can turn to for this information on future events is prophecy from God. And you're hearing some music. God didn't turn the music on. It's my cell phone going off, and I'll leave that call for after the show. Got about 5 minutes. So the only reliable source, he says, that you can turn to for information on future events is the prophecy from God. And he says, and this goes on the heels of my show yesterday, that the Bible has predicted one event after another down through history, and the events have occurred exactly as that has occurred, as the Bible has predicted. With the same unerring accuracy, the Bible predicts future events, and it shows the results that will occur as a result of the Jesuits' conspiracy to rule this world. The chapter in the Bible that reveals the results of the Jesuits' treachery is, and I ask you that question, what do you think it is? All you Bible readers out there, what a book? Well, if you said Revelation, you're right, Revelation 13. This is according to Bill Hughes. Like I said, there's a lot of different interpretations. You may have a different one, and that's your right as an American citizen under the Constitution to disagree or agree. There are two beasts mentioned in this chapter, he says. The first one rises out of the sea in verse 1, and the second one rises out of the earth in verse 2. So we got one coming out of the sea. I don't see them now coming out of the ocean. I'm looking at the ocean. And I'm not making fun of this. I'm just saying that's what this book says, according to Bill Hughes. Notice the reading of these verses. First one, and I stood upon the sand of the sea and saw a beast rise up out of the sea, Revelation 13:1. And I behold another beast coming out of the earth, Revelation 13:11. In order to understand these verses, said Bill Hughes, and thank you, Bill, I need to understand this, we must determine what a beast represents in Bible prophecy. Now, a beast is not, you know, Beauty and the Beast that we see on Disney, or, you know, what you consider to be a beast. You know, when you call your you beast, I've been called that by women. Oh, you're a beast. You know, maybe in jest or maybe she meant it. But anyway, and that's probably because I didn't listen or didn't eat dinner or something like that. Now, watch how the Bible interprets itself, it says. The book of Daniel, now we have to go back to Daniel, and shows that a beast represents a kingdom. Okay, so the beast is a kingdom. Or, as we would say today, a nation or country. Pretty simple to make that, yeah. These great beasts in Daniel, so great kingdoms, countries, nations, which are four kings, which shall arise out of the earth. Thus, he said, the fourth beast shall be the fourth kingdom upon earth, which shall be diverse, different from the other kingdoms. Thus we see that Revelation 13 discusses two powers that come to prominence in the world. These two powers have their beginnings in different areas of the world. One rises out of the sea, and the other rises out of the earth. Next, we discover what water represents in the Bible prophecy. And thus saith truth, the waters which thou sawest, where the whore sitteth, are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues, Revelation 17:15. We see here that this first power in Revelation 13 had its beginning in a heavily populated area of a world amid existing nations. This suggests that the first power came up in a populated area of Europe. The second world power of Revelation 13:11 rises out of the earth, which means it arose in an area of the world where few inhabitants existed. This suggests the rise of the second power occurred in the Western Hemisphere, where the population density was very light. Here is more information about the first beast. Having seven heads and ten horns, and upon his horns ten crowns, and upon his head the name of blasphemy. And the beast which I saw was like unto a leopard, And his feet were as the feet of a bear, and his mouth as the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him his power and his seat and a great authority. That was said in Revelation 13:1-2. There is also more information about the second beast. And I behold another beast coming out of the earth, and had two horns like a lamb, and he spake as a dragon. Revelation 13:11. So, what is this, you know, when I'm going through this, my first reaction is, boy, this would be easy for people not to understand, unless you really want to use your head here. Now, what would benefit the Bible, what would benefit the Vatican the most on verses like this? To ignore them, and when you read them, they don't make any sense unless you really start researching it and understanding the symbols and how this is used. So what would they be best doing? They'd be best just saying, read Psalms and enjoy and read all the great things in the Bible if you're going to do that. But let's stay away from these things, because they realize that if you do your homework, you're going to find that it points to them. Now, with about a minute to go, I could continue by looking at the meanings of the words blasphemy, dragon, lamb in these verses, but I can't because I don't have the time today. But I will mark this and get back to it another time. But this will give you an opportunity to begin, do your own research on this, and see what Bill Hughes is saying regarding how the Bible points to who we are talking about in this show, and what God's plan for them is. And I think that's a pretty good reference point when people are asking, what's going to happen tomorrow? How do I know? I don't. But I like to look at references like this that help us try to understand. Because, it's a natural thing that man wants to know. Like I'm thinking right now, what am I going to do tomorrow? All right? It's natural. So anyway, I hope that helped you a little bit. We'll get back. I'm going to reference that point because I want to, when I get back into this, I want to go back to that point, the two beasts and all this stuff. And I'm sure many of you out there have looked at this. Many of you haven't. If you haven't, please do. It won't hurt. It doesn't bite. The Bible doesn't bite. And it's not something that should be overlooked. It's a book that should be read. And it's a book that you can interpret if you take the time. Well, with that, I want to say good night, and I will see you tomorrow.